Welcome to the Healing Plate Podcast. Whole food, real nutrients every day. Healing for your body, the way it was designed to be.
You know, we spend like an enormous amount of time worrying about our body's fragile software.
Oh, absolutely. The vitamins.
Right, the vitamins. We just obsess over them. And they're these incredibly delicate, complex, organic molecules. I mean, they're held together by carbon bonds that will essentially snap if you just, you know, look at them wrong.
Yeah, they really are. It is kind of the ultimate vulnerability of organic chemistry.
Exactly. Like, if you expose a vitamin to a little too much kinetic energy by boiling it, or even if you just leave a transparent bottle of vitamin C on a sunny kitchen counter.
Oh, that's the worst thing you can do.
Right. The organic compounds just degrade. The nutritional value is basically completely oxidized away.
Yeah, vitamins are incredibly powerful, but their structural integrity is temporary. They're highly susceptible to heat, light, ambient oxidation, you name it.
But then you flip the nutritional coin, and you are staring at the indestructible hardware.
Yes, the mineral.
I am talking about minerals. And welcome to episode 5 of our series, The Healing Plate, where today we are doing a deep dive into exactly that. We're going to decode this hardware.
It's such an important topic.
It really is.
Yeah.
And for you listening, our mission today is to unpack what minerals actually are using some incredible research notes and data from the NIH, Medline Plus, the National Academies, and the Dietary Guidelines for Americans for 2025 to 2030.
Which is a fantastic bedrock of data to work from.
Yeah, it is. Because we need to explain the critical differences between major and trace minerals.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, explore why this modern habit of relying on electrolyte packets and bone pills is just completely missing how our bodies actually work. Because you cannot destroy a mineral by boiling it.
No, you can't.
You can't burn it away or degrade it with a UV ray.
Mm-hmm.
When you eat minerals, you are literally consuming a piece of the earth, like elements straight off the periodic table.
Right. Indestructible hardware is really the perfect way to frame it because they are inorganic.
Meaning no carbon, right?
Yeah, exactly. Meaning they contain no carbon, so minerals just do not degrade. They originate deep in the soil. They're pulled up by the root systems of plants. And eventually, they end up in your cells.
Which is wild.
It is. And our bodies have been created as a phenomenally complex system, one that is perfectly designed to take in these raw inorganic elements and utilize them to run our neurological networks or structurally reinforce our skeletons. But your body cannot manufacture a single atom of calcium or zinc.
Not one.
Not a single one. It is a strictly import-only situation.
I want to stick with that indestructible nature for a second because I feel like this completely changes how we think about cooking.
Oh, for sure.
So if you make a massive pot of vegetable soup and you accidentally leave it simmering for 4 hours on the stove, you haven't ruined the mineral profile.
Not at all.
The heat didn't destroy the potassium or the magnesium. I mean, those elements might have leached out of the cellular walls of the carrots and into water. But as long as you're drinking the broth, you're still consuming the exact same mineral load.
Yeah, the elements themselves remain completely intact. However, there is a catch.
There's always a catch.
There really is. While you can't destroy a mineral with temperature, you can drastically alter its bioavailability through chemical binding. And this is a mechanism that people rarely understand.
Okay, walk us through that.
Well, the human gut is a highly reactive chemical environment. So while a mineral itself is indestructible, it can get locked into an insoluble complex by other compounds that are present in your food.
So we're talking about chemical trapping.
Basically.
How does that actually work at a molecular level?
It's a process called chelation. Take phytates, which are found heavily in whole grains and legumes, or oxalates, which are really prevalent in dark leafy greens like spinach.
Okay, spinach, yeah.
These compounds essentially act as molecular claws. They have a strong negative charge, and minerals like calcium or iron have a positive charge. They're patients.
So opposites attract.
Exactly. The oxalate binds tightly to the calcium cation, and it creates this lattice structure that your digestive enzymes simply cannot break apart.
Wait, so you could eat a massive spinach salad thinking you were just flooding your system with calcium, But because of that ionic bond, the calcium is essentially locked in a cage.
Yes.
And it just passes right through you unabsorbed.
Precisely. The calcium is physically there in the spinach, but it is not bioavailable.
Wow.
This is actually the physiological rationale behind why a highly varied diet is completely non-negotiable for this complex system of ours. If you rely on a single plant source for a specific mineral, you might be simultaneously consuming the exact chelator that prevents its absorption.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, so when you mix your sources getting calcium from dairy and then from broccoli, maybe some almonds, you introduce different chemical environments and competitive binding affinities. That ensures a much, much higher net absorption.
That makes perfect sense. I mean, we're managing a chemical matrix, not just a, you know, a checklist of ingredients on the back of a box. So moving from how we absorb them to how much we actually need. If minerals are the body's hardware, the logical next step in this deep dive is quantifying the load.
Right.
And the medical consensus, which we pulled from places like Medline Plus and the National Academies, it cleanly divides minerals into two categories. You've got macro minerals or major minerals and trace minerals. And the dividing line seems to be 100 milligrams a day.
That is the threshold, yes. Major minerals, which includes calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, sodium, and potassium, they're required in doses larger than 100 milligrams per day.
Right.
Some of them you actually need in quantities of several grams. Trace minerals, on the other hand, like iron, zinc, iodine, and selenium, they are required in drastically smaller amounts, sometimes just microscopic micrograms.
I have to admit, the terminology really bothers me here.
Oh, how so?
Well, when an intelligent person hears the word trace mineral, the immediate psychological response is to classify it as a footnote.
Ah, I see what you mean.
Right. Like, a trace implies it's a dietary afterthought. It sounds optional. But why is there such a massive discrepancy in the sheer volume we require? Why do I need literal grams of one element and a microscopic speck of another?
It's a great question. It basically comes down to their functional roles within our physiological system.
Okay.
Major minerals are largely structural and osmotic. They physically build the scaffolding of your body, like how calcium and phosphorus synthesize into hydroxyapatite to form your bones.
Right, the heavy lifting.
Exactly. Or they act as bulk fluid managers, maintaining your blood volume and cellular hydration. You need a lot of them because they are literally doing physical structural work. Trace minerals, conversely, are primarily catalytic.
Catalytic meaning what?
Meaning they aren't building structures. They are the specific keys that unlock enzymatic reactions.
Oh, I see. So they don't need mass. They just need to be present to trigger the reaction.
Exactly. Let's look at iodine. The body's requirement is measured in just 150 micrograms for an adult.
That is tiny.
It is an incredibly small volume, but iodine's primary role is being incorporated into the molecular structure of thyroid hormones, thyroxine and triiodothyronine.
Okay.
Those iodine atoms literally shape the hormones so it can bind to receptors and dictate your entire basal metabolic rate. Without that tiny trace amount, the thyroid just cannot synthesize the hormone. The metabolic engine stalls.
Wow.
And in a developing fetus, a lack of that precise microscopic trace permanently compromises neurological development.
Okay, so small definitely does not mean optional. That is so critical for people to hear. And iron falls into that trace category as well, which is interesting because it seems to be the one trace mineral people constantly struggle to maintain.
Yeah, the requirements are highly specific. It's about 18 milligrams for adult women and 8 milligrams for adult men.
Okay.
Our bodies run a very tight closed-loop recycling program for iron. It salvages it from old red blood cells to synthesize new hemoglobin, but because it is a closed loop, any loss of blood disrupts the entire system.
Which explains so much.
Right. This is why women who menstruate can quickly fall into severe deficiency, struggling with profound fatigue and compromised oxygen transport, even if their diet seems adequate on paper.
Right, because they're constantly losing from that closed loop. Which brings us to the minerals that are doing that heavy structural and osmotic lifting we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you look at the major minerals, there are two that represent what is probably the single most dangerous dietary imbalance in modern society.
Yes.
I am talking about the electrolyte seesaw, sodium and potassium.
Oh, this is arguably the most critical moment-to-moment mineral interaction in human physiology.
Break that down for us.
Well, we have an electrolyte gradient across every cellular membrane in our bodies, and it's primarily managed by sodium and potassium. Sodium is your dominant extracellular mineral. It dictates the fluid volume outside your cells.
Okay, so sodium is outside.
Yes. And potassium is your dominant intracellular mineral. It lives inside the cells.
And it isn't just about hydration, right? Like, this is an actual electrical mechanism.
Absolutely. It's the sodium-potassium pump.
Right. Because when a nerve fires or a muscle contracts, it is literally because the cell membrane opens and sodium rushes in while potassium rushes out. That rapid swap of positive ions creates an action potential.
Which is the electrical charge that beats your heart.
Which is just incredible. Our bodies are so phenomenally complex.
They really are. And this pump, it is an active, energy-demanding process. Your body spends a massive percentage of its daily resting energy. It's ATP, just pumping those minerals back to their proper sides of the membrane to maintain that resting electrical potential.
But the modern diet has completely inverted the raw materials that the system relies on, right? I mean, you look at the dietary guidelines for Americans for 2025 to 2030, the data is just stark. The target for anyone 14 and older is to stay under 2,300 milligrams of sodium a day.
Under 2,300 milligrams, yes.
And if we're being honest, most people are blowing past that limit by, like, Tuesday lunchtime. But the mechanism behind this overconsumption is what's really interesting. Because people constantly defend their diets by saying, you know, I don't even own a salt shaker. They view sodium strictly as a flavor enhancer. But we aren't eating too much sodium because we just crave salt.
No, we are consuming it due to what food scientists call the coincidence of processing.
Coincidence of processing.
Yeah. Sodium is not just a flavor profile. It's a highly effective, cheap texturizer and preservative.
Right.
When manufacturers process meats, soups, freezer meals, they use heavy loads of sodium to physically alter the protein structures. The sodium causes those proteins to uncoil and bind with water.
So it puffs it up.
Exactly. This increases the weight of the product, which is great for their bottom line. It extends the shelf life by reducing free water activity that bacteria could use, and it creates a highly specific, desirable mouthfeel.
Okay, so we are ingesting a massive extracellular load just because a manufacturer wanted a frozen chicken patty to hold on to its moisture.
Pretty much.
And because sodium pulls water with it, this floods the bloodstream with excess fluid, forcing the heart to pump a higher volume of liquid through the exact same narrow pipes. We are literally inducing high blood pressure through food texture engineering.
And that is only half the crisis.
Oh, right. Because of the seesaw.
Exactly. While we are flooding the outside of the cell with sodium, we are simultaneously starving the inside of the cell of potassium.
Right.
The adequate intake for potassium is massive, 2,600 milligrams for women, 3,400 milligrams for men. And it is found almost exclusively in the intracellular matrix of real whole plants. Beans, dark leafy greens, potatoes baked with their skins.
But because processing strips away the cellular structure of plants, ultra-processed foods are practically devoid of potassium.
Exactly. So the seesaw breaks.
We have this massive extracellular pressure from sodium and almost zero intracellular pushback from potassium. It's like trying to run a high-voltage current through a frayed low-gauge wire. We are forcing a perfectly designed electrical system to operate under catastrophic duress.
That's a great analogy. You are forcing the kidneys into overdrive. They're desperately trying to excrete the sodium while trying to retain whatever trace amounts of potassium they can salvage. It is just a biochemical nightmare for the renal and cardiovascular systems.
So fixing the major minerals is largely about navigating away from the hyperprocessed foods and returning to whole plants. But as we pivot back to the trace minerals, the strategy completely changes.
It does. It requires a different approach.
Right, because managing trace minerals isn't just about reading a nutrition label and dodging sodium. It's about navigating that highly reactive chemical environment we talked about earlier. Since trace minerals are catalytic, they're so eager to trigger reactions, they seem incredibly susceptible to being blocked or altered by what we eat alongside them.
They are exquisitely sensitive to their digestive environment. Let's revisit iron.
Okay.
We know it's critical for oxygen transport, but dietary iron comes in two distinct structural formats. You have heme iron, which comes from animal tissues. The iron atom is safely nested inside a porphyrin ring.
A porphyrin ring. Okay.
Yeah, it's a specific protein structure that the human gut actually has dedicated receptors for. So it's absorbed highly efficiently.
But then you have non-heme iron, which comes from plant sources like lentils, beans, spinach. And non-heme iron doesn't have that protective ring, making it a free ion that is highly reactive.
Yes, Non-heme iron generally exists in a ferric state, meaning it has a specific oxidized chemical structure that doesn't easily cross the intestinal wall. It needs a chemical assist to be absorbed.
Okay, so how do we give it that assist?
This is where food pairing becomes biological engineering. If you consume ascorbic acid vitamin C alongside that spinach or those lentils, it actually reduces the ferric iron into a ferrous state.
Oh, why?
It changes the electron configuration of the iron atom on the spot, making it highly soluble and vastly easier for the gut to absorb.
So, like, a squeeze of lemon juice on a spinach salad isn't just a culinary choice. It is a rapid chemical reduction that unlocks the hardware. But the inverse is also true, right? Like, if I sit down and eat that same lentil dish with a cup of black tea, I am actively sabotaging the absorption.
Significantly, yeah. Black tea and coffee contain tannins and polyphenols. When they encounter that free, non-heme iron in the acidic environment of the stomach, they bind together. They create massive, insoluble macromolecular complexes.
Massive complexes.
Yeah, they form a structure so physically large that it simply cannot pass through the cellular receptors in the intestinal wall. The iron is effectively trapped, and you just excrete it.
This reactivity brings up a trend that I really want to unpack here.
Mm-hmm.
Because trace minerals like zinc and selenium are so crucial for enzymatic reactions.
Yeah.
You know, zinc for immune cell function, selenium for activating antioxidant pathways. People have started treating them like biohacking candy.
Oh, the supplementation trend.
Yes. During cold season, it's completely normalized to just pop high-dose zinc lozenges all day long.
Oh.
Or someone hears that selenium supports the thyroid, so they start snacking on Brazil nuts by the handful. To me, it feels reckless.
It's not just reckless. It is actively toxic. Seriously.
Yes. Trace minerals are required in microscopic amounts because the window between sufficiency and toxicity is razor thin. Let's take selenium.
Okay.
The biological upper limit for an adult is 400 micrograms per day. A single Brazil nut, depending on the soil it was grown in, can contain up to 90 micrograms.
Wait, one nut?
One nut. So if you mindlessly eat a handful every afternoon, you are blowing past the toxicity threshold rapidly.
Wait, I want to clarify the mechanism there. If I overconsume selenium, what is actually happening at the cellular level? Why is it toxic?
It causes a condition called selenosis.
Selenosis, okay.
When you flood the system, your body starts accidentally substituting selenium in place of sulfur when it synthesizes certain amino acids.
Yo, that sounds bad.
It is. Keratin, the protein that builds your hair and nails, it relies on tight sulfur-to-sulfur bonds for its structural integrity. When selenium swaps in, those bonds fail.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. The classic clinical presentation of selenium toxicity is profound hair loss and your fingernails literally becoming brittle and sloughing off. That is horrifying. So the structural integrity of the protein just dissolves because the wrong trace element forced its way into the assembly line.
That's exactly what happens.
And you see a similar competitive issue with zinc, right?
Yeah.
Like if someone is constantly sucking on high-dose zinc lozenges, they aren't just boosting their immunity, they are causing a traffic jam for other minerals.
Yes, it is an issue of competitive binding affinity. In your intestinal lining, zinc and copper utilize the exact same transport protein, it's called metallothionein, to cross into the bloodstream.
Okay.
When you consume massive supplemental doses of zinc, your body upregulates the production of this transporter to handle the load. The problem is, this transporter actually has a higher chemical affinity for copper.
Oh, so the copper gets trapped.
Exactly. The metallothionein grabs onto the copper in your gut, but because the system is completely overwhelmed by the zinc signaling, it traps the copper inside the intestinal cell.
But then what happens to it?
Those cells eventually die and are naturally sloughed off into the digestive tract. So by taking too much zinc, you actively strip the body of copper, inducing a severe deficiency that leads to anemia and deep neurological issues.
Wow. And this perfectly tees up what might be the most pervasive, invisible health crisis in the modern wellness space. Because of these distinct dangers, toxicity and competitive absorption, we really have to talk about the modern obsession with stacking supplements.
It's a huge issue.
We aren't just eating food anymore. We eat fortified cereals, we drink highly engineered electrolyte waters, we take daily multivitamins, and then we pop isolated calcium pills before bed.
Right. And over half of U.S. adults regularly take some form of dietary supplement, often layering them on top of a highly fortified diet. What people fail to realize is that the recommended dietary allowance, the RDA, is a measure of your total systemic intake.
Right. The total bucket.
Yes. It accounts for the food matrix, the fortification, and the pills. When you stack these high-O supplements, you are creating an immense acute toxic burden on a system that is calibrated for slow, steady dietary extraction.
Let's use calcium as the prime example here, because this is where the stacking mentality really falls apart.
Yeah.
Let's say someone wants to protect their bone density, so they take a massive 1,000 milligram calcium pill. Why is the body's reaction to that pill fundamentally different than its reaction to eating, say, a bowl of yogurt and some broccoli? I mean, the element is the same, is it?
The element is the same, but the delivery mechanism changes everything.
How so?
When you consume calcium in a whole food matrix like dairy or cruciferous vegetables, the mineral is bound up in proteins and lipids. Your digestive system has to work to break those structures down.
Right, it takes time.
Exactly. This results in a slow, steady release of calcium into the bloodstream over several hours. The serum calcium levels remain perfectly stable.
So it's a natural time release system designed by nature.
Precisely. But when you swallow a concentrated, highly soluble calcium pill, there is no food matrix to break down. It dissolves instantly, causing a rapid artificial spike in your blood calcium levels.
Which the body doesn't like.
No. Your system registers this acute spike as a threat, and the kidneys immediately go to work to filter the excess out of the blood. This supersaturates your urine with calcium rapidly. The calcium then crystallizes in the renal system, drastically increasing the risk of kidney stones.
Unbelievable.
Food calcium protects the system. Isolated, high-dose pill calcium overwhelms the renal filters.
And it goes right back to that competitive absorption we talked about with zinc and copper. If someone decides to take a high-dose calcium pill and a high-dose iron pill at the exact same time because they want to, you know, cover their bases, they are sharing the same divalent metal transporters in the gut.
Yes.
So they structurally block each other. You swallow both pills, but you absorb a fraction of either.
Which brings us to the core philosophy outlined by clinical dietitians and the dietary guidelines. The bottle is not a soil substitute.
I really want to highlight that. The bottle is not a soil substitute. It implies that the context of the nutrient is just as important as the nutrient itself.
It is the absolute truth of human biochemistry. The whole food matrix does the pairing that the isolation of a pill completely forgets. When you consume a serving of black beans, you aren't just getting iron. Nature provides that iron beautifully intertwined with folate and magnesium, surrounded by fiber that regulates the speed of digestion.
Wow.
And a serving of yogurt delivers calcium perfectly balanced with potassium and phosphorus.
So the food essentially acts as an instruction manual, delivering the hardware exactly how the body's cellular machinery expects to receive it.
Yes, the system is exquisitely calibrated to extract what it needs from a complex matrix. Now, this doesn't mean supplements have absolutely no place.
Right.
If a clinician runs a serum ferritin test and confirms you have iron deficiency anemia, or if you are pregnant and your blood volume is actively doubling to support a fetus, or say a strict vegan diet creates an unbridgeable gap.
Then you need them.
Then you utilize a targeted supplement as a medical intervention. You use it under clinical supervision to correct a documented deficit. You do not start stacking isolated high-dose heavy metals into your digestive tract just because a wellness influencer told you it optimizes cellular energy.
Yeah. So for everyone listening, if you're looking at your own plate right now, how do you actually apply this?
Yeah.
What is the practical takeaway for managing this indestructible hardware?
It means respecting the design of the system. You manage the major minerals, the structural and osmotic load, by cutting the ultra-processed foods. You stop flooding the extracellular matrix with industrial sodium texturizers, and you repopulate the intracellular space with potassium from whole plants, potatoes, legumes, avocados.
And for the trace minerals, it's about diversity, not dosage. It's avoiding the trap of eating the same three fortified foods every single day. You have to let the food matrix do the heavy lifting of balancing iron, zinc, and selenium. So add the vitamin C to your plant-based iron. Use a modest amount of iodized salt in your home cooking to protect your thyroid. And just step away from the vanity supplements that just create chemical traffic jams in your gut.
The resilience of our body's design is profound, but it demands the right raw materials in the correct biological context.
It really does. And I want to leave everyone with a final broader thought to mull over today. Something that steps outside the biochemistry of the human gut and looks at the origin of this hardware.
Okay.
Because we established at the very top of our deep dive that minerals are strictly imported. The human body, as amazingly complex as it is, cannot synthesize a single atom of them. They must be drawn from the earth.
We are entirely reliant on the soil composition.
Exactly. So if this complex system of ours relies 100% on the Earth to provide this indispensable hardware, what happens to our baseline physiological health as modern, highly aggressive agricultural practices continue to rapidly strip the soil of these exact elements?
It's a huge concern.
Because if the minerals are depleted from the soil, they cannot be pulled up by the root structures of the crops. And if they aren't in the plant matrix, they aren't entering your cells.
It is a really sobering reality. The biochemical perfection of our digestion doesn't matter if the raw elements are absent before the harvest even begins.
What happens when the indestructible hardware goes missing before the food even has a chance to grow? It is a vital question for the future of nutrition. Thank you for joining us for episode 5. Until next time, keep digging deep.
Thank you for listening to the Healing Plate Podcast. Eat well and be happy.